Good morning. We are going to get started. I think we're expecting, I don't know how the line was outside, expecting a few more folks. We got a lot of ground to cover this morning, a very tight schedule, so we will kick things off. So good morning. My name is Clarence Wardell. I'm currently a member of the U.S. Digital Service here at the White House and kind of one of the co-conspirators here on the police data initiative that cajoled and coaxed a lot of you here today. It's good to see faces. I've met many of you via email or through the phone already. I'm so happy that you all can make it here, and it is a distinct honor and pleasure for me to welcome you on behalf of the White House. So I just kind of want to level set a little bit for the day, but before I do that, just kind of want to say we've tried to curate a day here to not only help you get a sense of what's been accomplished under the Police Data Initiative over the past year, but also to understand all the work that's left to do. We've had a great start over the past year, thanks to you all. But as you know, there's still so much more to do. And in part of that is recognizing that today is not, we don't just have a room full of law enforcement agencies and officers here. We have a diverse collection of folks from civic technologists backgrounds, researchers, community activists. And the theme that we really want to stress here today is that this work has to be done as a community. And it's not just one group or the other. And so we hope that that becomes clear throughout the course of the day. Before diving in, I'd like to just take a few moments to thank some folks who have really helped make this happen from its beginning and over the past year. You'll meet most of them today. My colleague Denise Ross and my co-conspirator and pretty much everything PDI and a lot of stuff otherwise, who most of you I'm sure have talked to. Lynn Overman, who I haven't seen yet, was kind of one of the initial trio on PDI. And just a few folks in the building here who believed in this effort early on when we honestly got laughed out of the room by quite a few folks when we suggested that we could get police departments to voluntarily share their information. So it was Roy Austin and his team in the Office of Urban Affairs, Justice and Economic Opportunity, Megan Smith and DJ Patel, the U.S. Chief Technologies Officer's Office, Dave Wilkinson and his team at the Office of Social Innovation, Garen Givens, who was the Director of the Presidential Innovation Fellows team. And also our co-host here the Department of Justice Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services. Those folks will kind of be in and out today. They're actually running a concurrent event across town as well, but we're really glad to have them as partners in this work as well. And then lastly, I would be remiss, and you will see them around today, to thank our awesome intern team, who has undoubtedly helped make all of this happen. And so thank you. With that, I do want to do a little bit of level setting on what is the Police Data Initiative. We keep talking about this thing. It's become a little clear to me that I think over the past year, some people like to project onto it what they think it is. And so maybe just taking a step back, maybe a quick show of hands, this thing kind of really kicked off last April. I know there's some folks who were in the room last April. Can I just see a quick show of hands? Right. So those are going to be your guides for the rest of the day. Keep those hands up. So what is PDI and what is this work that we keep talking about? At its core, it's a pretty simple idea. It's just a community of practice of police departments, law enforcement agencies across the country who've made commitments to release very specifically at least 3 data sets around police-citizen interactions. These are things like officer-involved shootings, use of force, traffic stops, assaults on officers, community meetings attended, really a push towards openness and transparency around the holistic framework of policing. And so I think we tend to think in terms of crime data, but there's so much more that affects how police and citizen police and citizens interact and tells us a lot about what that looks like in the community. The Police Data Initiative is a collection of agencies and departments who have made that commitment towards working towards releasing those data sets. It doesn't mean that they're released the day after they make the commitment. We understand this is a process, not a product, that what we're trying to do here is set up sustainable systems and a sustainable community so that over time this data transparency will hopefully lead to trust within the community. It's just one piece of a larger conversation and framework for policing, or the police reform conversation, if you will, that occurred I think, in some sense, an inflection point of fall 2014. But we think it's definitely very critical and important work. The other thing that I do want to stress is that this is it's the White House, but it's a local initiative. You know, we often get questions of, where's the White House keeping the data? We don't got it. It is a local initiative. We're not prescribing any particular standards right now. Like, our whole focus is on enabling departments to respond locally to the needs of the community there. If the community says we want this data standardized relative to somebody else, that's a conversation that should happen. But right now, we're trying to put in place the resources to support that work. I had a few other slides here that we were going to go through. I may just kind of skip past them a little bit and get to the meaty portion of this. But I think we all kind of know, almost without saying, what the backdrop for a lot of this work has been, beginning in fall 2014 and then really pushed forward through the President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing and the 59 recommendations that came out of there. And if you look across that report, it's littered with recommendations around use of technology, data, and transparency to increase trust within communities. We had a notion last year that we could bring together civic technologists, police departments, researchers, and folks to start to problem solve and to make commitments. We looked around the country and we saw a lot of police departments who were starting to lean forward in this space, and folks who you'll hear from today, like Chief David Brown here from Dallas, Texas, who were already doing this work. And so when folks were telling us, well, departments won't open up that data, we said, They're already doing it. So how do we bring the folks who are leading on this issue already together, uplift them, and really set the standard for what 21st century policing looks like? That's what last April was about. The guy there is DJ, who you'll hear from a little bit later, who's checking his BlackBerry, I think, there. Those were the initial commitments that were made that really seeded a lot of this work. I think that commitment board still exists somewhere in Megan's office. And so we're going to, for those of you who were here last year, we're just going to do an audit to make sure that everyone actually fulfilled those commitments at the end of the day. And so this is a little bit of what I spoke about, but it really is rooted in community-based, not just at the local level, but amongst us, right? And we've had a lot of great support from organizations like the Police Foundation, Sunlight Foundation, Code for America, nonprofit and community advocacy organizations who have come together and worked with the police departments, and you hear a lot about that story of collaboration today. And so let me just wrap up here with a few numbers, since this is the data initiative, on where we've come over the past year. We had 14 commitments last April leaving that room. By the time the president officially announced the initiative in May of that year, we had 21 law enforcement agencies signed on. Today, we're happy to say we have 53 law enforcement agencies from across the country signed on, pledged to make this commitment towards being more open and transparent around police data, and using that then as a framework and tool to engage the community and have a two-way dialogue rooted in facts. You can see the organizations there. These jurisdictions cover over 40 million individuals across the country. From last year, we've had close to 100 data sets released. I believe the exact number is 96. But if you kind of want to keep a real-time tally of what's been released, the Police Foundation has actually set up a site where they're helping kind of catalog and monitor what some of the activity around police data initiative has been. And that's policedatainitiative.org. Some other numbers, we've had approximately, I believe, 40 community of practice phone calls every Thursday or every other Thursday. Most of you have been on these in some form or another, just quick 30-minute stand-up calls where we're just sharing across the country to see what folks are doing, to see if people have questions about how do I release use of force data, or how do I extract this data from my system here. And we think that's been beneficial, and we hope that it has helped kind of lay the foundation for accelerating this work moving forward. And then we've had at least 3 police data dive events, I believe, and those are, we'll hear a little bit about those later, and so I won't go into them too deeply, but this is using the data, again, not just opening the data, but then how do you use it as a convening force and a place to have a conversation and a place to understand what's going on in your community. And so I just want to end. It's not easy work, but it's important and necessary work, and if we're going to move forward, we have to do it together. And that will be the theme throughout the day. Encourage you all to have dialogue, to talk to one another, meet the folks sitting next to you. You all invited here for a reason. You have enormous contributions to provide, and we hope that you will find the day satisfying. So with that, I want to kick things off by bringing up the U.S. Chief Technology Officer, Ms. Megan Smith. September 2014, President Obama named Megan Smith the United States Chief Technology Officer in the Office of Science, Technology, and Policy. In this role, she serves as an assistant to the President, and as U.S. CTO, Ms. Smith focuses on how technology policy, data, and innovation can advance the future of our nation. Megan Smith is an award-winning entrepreneur and engineer. She most recently served as vice president at Google, first leading new business development, and later serving as a VP in the leadership team at Google X, and co-created the company Saw for X Innovation Community Project. She is a tireless advocate for better representation of both gender and ethnic diversity in the STEM fields. Megan was previously CEO of Planet Out, a leading LGBT online community in the early days of the web. Megan has served on the boards of MIT, MIT Media Lab, MIT Technology Review, Vital Voices. She is a member of the USAID Advisory Committee on Voluntary Foreign Aid, is an advisor and actually co-founder, I just found, of the Malala Fund. She holds a bachelor and master's degree in mechanical engineering from MIT, and she's completed her master and thesis work at MIT Media Lab. So with that, I welcome to the stage Megan Smith.
Hello. It's great to be here with you guys. I was there in that meeting, the few people who raised your hands. Thank you for your leadership and collaboration that day when we kicked this off just shy of a year ago, or actually just more than a year ago. So I guess where I wanted to start is just say thank you. We have 53 jurisdictions, teams from around the country, local teams, leadership signing up to participate with all of us and start collaborating. And so just really thank you to all of our leadership in the force. The leaders in the police data initiative have come together in the cities. And that represents about 90 data sets of information that we can dive into together and try to see what we can see to start solving problems in these new ways. You know, Clarence showed the picture of the president when the 21st Century Policing Task Force, the Task Force on 21st Century Policing was meeting. And in that, there were so many moments where we could see, as sort of tech folks, where we might be able to help our colleagues and come together and support on this idea of transparency of data, but also really cross-functional teams. The president was out South by Southwest earlier this spring talking with the community there, that creative collaboration, sort of artistic, techie flash mob, that Burning Man flash mob of folks who come together and really drive the innovation economy, and saying to them, not only do I want you to come rotate into government and I want you to help us with civics and civic participation, but I really want you to dive in together on our much more intractable problems. Continue to do all the amazing work on things in the sharing economy of delivering food from restaurants and sharing spaces in cars and, you know, sort of that whole area of search and innovation and technology that's coming. But in addition to serving ads and e-commerce, let's dive in to these problems and see how we could collaborate together to solve justice problems, equality problems, how we can work together on engaging all of our youth. You know, whether it's computer science for all and the president's initiative to pull kids into coding and technology and those pieces. So I just wanted to kind of check in on who's all here. So first off, all of our leadership from the force, the police leadership here, just raise hands so you can see. Yeah, we have an amazing group, so thank you for being here. Also technology people. So there's a whole group of you here. I know that many of you are going to be presenting together. One of my favorite collaborations that'll be up today is the Charlotte Mecklenburg leadership together with the University of Chicago, which is really in the theme of what I was just saying. So this is our colleagues in the university sector who are working on artificial intelligence and machine learning and data science, and they can continue working the field on algorithms for advertising and algorithms for playing games and chess and Go and that stuff, but also please come and work on the data sets around criminal justice and solutions and that work on the area for environment today, Earth Day, you know, sort of climate change and disaster response, work on the data sets from the Department of Labor. so that we can have jobs for all Americans, because we could use machine learning to better match ourselves and figure out what people's passions are. So thinking really creatively about the cross-functionality that we now have, we have, as humanity, built the internet, and we see extraordinary things out of that, like Wikipedia. I mean, who thought that we could together write all of our knowledge in this sharing way that is now available to each other? That's an amazing accomplishment as humanity. And so now, how do we move ourselves into these harder problems and get cross-functional in those? And that's really what today is about. So it looks like innovation from local teams. The way that we often work, you know, that Clarence was talking about, our leadership in Dallas, our leadership in LA, our leadership, Charlotte Mecklenburg, I mentioned, Camden, other places who are already have figured this out locally. How do we get us all together into communities where they can communicate almost like a TED-style lightning talk? What have they created? What have they found? What have they done in their local community that's really creating results that other people could borrow and advance and iterate on? And we can bring America together in our federated way that we're so good at and share all these great things, these great solutions that we've made. And I know you guys are going to move into that part of the program where you start cross-sharing innovation, and then we'll work and move into workshopping. I think also one of the things that's really interesting to me in watching this is some of the surprising teammates you don't think of right away. So I talked about the police leadership, and I talked about the technical leadership. There's other civic leaders and community leaders and folks from civil society. Who else is here from those groups? You've got a couple people there. So one of my favorite ones, in a different topic last week, we were working on global connectivity, working on making sure broadband access is available to people all over the world, across North America, across the United States, rural, tribal, in our schools, in our urban poor areas, that everybody, you know, we need to not have a homework gap for young people to do their homework when they get home because people are not online. That's the same thing all around the world, these amazing things that we have. And so in that particular cross-functional team, we had an incredible librarian from Chattanooga. And I know the Chattanooga team is part of the Police Data Initiative. And she was bringing her knowledge as a librarian and the high-speed internet that's available in Chattanooga, how they've worked together in a different way there, and they have very high-speed internet. I know that Seattle is here. Seattle just did a hack the commute. So the chief technology officer there, together with the civic leadership, got together and with the librarians and others, and the community came together to think together in creative ways, cross-functionality, about how to reduce the commute load in Seattle, and came up with a fabulous innovation. So it's in this sort of unusual interconnect. One of my favorite ones, you'll probably see an image of young Grace, who's from New Orleans, a 10th grader, who has learned to code and was teaching the chief of police in New Orleans some of her skills and how he might join Police Data Initiative. So these unexpected teammates. She, in her high school, is now teaching younger kids. And so you could imagine tapping the high school kids in your community. How might they help on this transparency innovation? How might they get involved? They would love to serve. They would love to do this. They don't realize possibly that computer science could solve some of these challenges in the community. And so having them come into the teams is a real opportunity. So it's in that intermix that we're hoping to see today emerge. It came for the Police Data Initiative happened in the same way for us, where the Presidential Innovation Fellows, techies, together with Roy Austin's team, as they were looking at the data initiative and what we might do and what the task force said. So I will leave you with that charge of how can we work together? How do we build public trust by including each other and getting into these conversations? I would note that yesterday we had an incredible gathering in the afternoon of those who are diving into that data set of around domestic violence and sexual assault. And so I think also in this conversation, there have been some great insights about things that people are doing with that data set, juvenile data sets, things that are around police personnel, things that you might handle differently. Privacy issues abound across all of these data sets, but especially in those particular data sets. And so it will be in not just saying, oh, we can't post that, but saying, how might we work together with these data sets in a new way that will allow us to build trust and reveal what's happening in our communities so we're much more aware. And I would say this is not that much of a brand new idea. Yesterday, the Treasury Department announced this amazing thing of how we're going to evolve our money. and celebrate All Americans on the Money. And one of the bills, the $10 bill, will have the suffrage leadership on the back, because they marched from Capitol Hill to the Treasury Department. And so the Treasury picture there, they're going to be added to that. And so one of the people in that parade was Ida B. Wells. And Ida B. Wells is one of the greatest data scientists in our country, who lived in the late 1800s. She was able to use the data set from lynching at the time to reveal to Americans what was really happening at scale in our country and drive the compassion. It was in that transparency, together with her brilliant journalistic techniques of telling the stories, that we transformed a little in that moment. And so I kind of think of Ida today, and how can we stand on the shoulders of her as a giant of those times, to think about the police data initiative, what might we get up to in our Wikipedia way with these data sets to really help each other and evolve our communities. The United Nations met in September to ratify the Sustainable Development Goals, the 17 goals that the countries and the leadership of our world have set for all of us for the next 15 years. And in there is equality and justice, and security and safety and economic opportunity and prosperity, as well as, of course, Earth Day, all the things about oceans and the planet that we should get up to. And so I think of this calling that we have and this opportunity we have that comes from all history of collaboration, standing on those shoulders and then stepping into this new place that we have, where we have this internet tool that really is just all of us connected in a new way. And how do we work as amazing leaders in our local communities to drive this forward and then share across and be a collaborative team locally operating and then working on what we're doing. So I thank everybody for being here. I know you're going to hear from Valerie Jarrett later, who's really championed across all of the president's initiatives in this area with everybody. But you know, this is a big, this is a really important area for our country, and it's the area that the president is really asking us to step up and lead on. And I thank you so much for being here and doing that.
So next, I'm going to bring up, we're going to have a panel, Charting the Path for Open Data and Policing, moderated by someone who's been a tireless advocate, not only recently, but throughout the course of his career for criminal justice reform, and a guy who, when Denise and I walked into his office about a year ago and started talking about open data, he looked at us with bewilderment and I think almost kicked us out. But it's amazing to hear, kind of a year now, the way that Roy Austin has embraced this work, and it's really it's actually really awesome to hear him talk about it after a lot of the early conversations that we had. Roy has been a huge supporter of this work. It would not have happened, quite frankly, without his support. And so I'm just excited to welcome him to the stage. I should say Roy Austin is the Deputy Assistant to the President for Urban Affairs, Justice, and Opportunity. We'll lead our next panel.
So, first of all, welcome to the White House. Okay? Just to be fun. I should enjoy yourself. So it's always dangerous putting me behind a microphone. And so the first thing I need is a little call and response, and that is, data is cool. Let's hear it.
Data is cool.
Thank you. Okay, that's what I needed to get through this day. So let me start off with just, we're going to have our panelists come up, and they're going to very quickly talk about a little bit of their work, and then we'll do a panel with all of them. But let me start off with Chief David Brown from Dallas. So Chief Brown has been a police officer longer than I've been alive. He's been a police officer for 30 years. And he has a force of, or a group of employees, 4,000. He has an over $400 million budget. He's also served as the interim assistant city manager for the city of Dallas. He has both a BS and an MBA. And so with that, Chief Brown.
Sure, and thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited about the discussion today, but I really want to tell a story so we can be a little bit more engaging instead of just a PowerPoint presentation. So if that picture doesn't raise the hair on the back of your head, I don't know what will. And that happened to us in Dallas in 2012. And it seems that every law enforcement agency goes through its defining moments. That's one of our defining moments. And what's happening there is a large crowd has gathered because we've just had a police-involved shooting where one of our officers who happened to be white shoots an unarmed subject who happened to be black in one of our toughest black neighborhoods. And this is in the evening time when this occurs. And almost immediately, rumors spread throughout the community that the subject was shot while running away in the back. And our instincts told us that we maybe had the next news cycle in order to get out the facts of what happened in that incident, which would have been the 10 o'clock news. This happened around 6 in the evening, so we have a very short window to gather facts and share with the public what we knew. So we held a press conference and relayed the facts as we knew them. We debunked many of the rumors. We answered every question from reporters. And then we explained the investigative process and the steps and the adjudication process to the grand jury. The community returned to calm. The city calmed down. But here's what we learned. It starts with transparency. It starts with transparency. And trust is hard to earn and easy to lose. So this was just the beginning for us, this incident, of our steps to transform and reform our department's community policing efforts, community engagement efforts, training, policies, and accountability. This officer was no bill by the grand jury, by the way. So what we began to do as a department is we began looking at transparency first as the foundation of what we would build as far as more community trust, more community engagement, more community-oriented policing effort. So we believe first that the data we have belongs to citizens and that we're the caretakers of that data. That was a big step to make that our mantra, that the data was the citizens' data, not the police's data. And so what we began to do is we began to collect 12 years of our officer-involved shooting data and put it in a format that was not just statistics on a page that you couldn't understand. We tried to make it very visual, very understandable. We later partnered with the data initiative so that we can make it in a way that could be read across different disciplines, put it in Socrata data. And we published that for the public. And our media and our citizens really embraced this display of transparency. It's published online. The next legislative cycle, our state mandated all agencies in Texas publish data in this format. And Eric Johnson was the state rep that sponsored that bill to get that done. This data, by the way, that we release includes a synopsis. It includes the subjects and the officer's race. Much of what we deal with here in police-involved shootings and use of force, the undercurrent is about race. And so we believe it's important to share the subjects and the officer's race, gender, the condition of the subject, the grand jury disposition. It's formatted, again, very visually, where it compares this data across disciplines. At the time that we released this data, the value of trust hadn't really been appreciated by us as much, but this built quite a bit of trust. And along with this, you know, display, we improved our policies, and we believe the last component is we hold officers accountable that they don't follow our rules as it relates to use of force, use of deadly force. We also have reviewed consent decrees in other police departments throughout the city, throughout the country, to glean best practices, and we develop programs where our officers interact with our young people in our city so that we can build greater community engagement. Back to the accountability component of transparency, we have had two officers terminated from employment and indicted the year following. But we believe that holding the small number of officers accountable protects the integrity of the vast majority of officers who uphold the standards of our noble profession. The results, I'm going to close with the results. In 2015, our department's excessive force complaints were reduced by 67%, and our use of force, our deadly force incidents have been reduced by 45%. So far this year in 2016, we've had 4 excessive force complaints. We average between 150 and 200 my whole 33-year career. So this is transformative. And we've averaged between 18 and 25 police-involved shootings my whole career. We have had 2 so far this year. Knock on wood, brother. Knock on wood. And let me close. We've also had 12 consecutive years of crime decline, unprecedented in Dallas, the most dramatic decline in our city's history. Again, transparency is the beginning point, but you also have to have policy training, and you have to hold the small few number of officers accountable so that you can protect the integrity of the vast majority that make us all proud. Thank you so much.
So now let me introduce Wendy Harn. She is the Chief Data Officer with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. She was hired in the Sheriff's Department in 1985, and prior to that, she spent 8 years working for the South Bay Los Angeles Burglary Team, an 18-agency multi-jurisdictional burglary apprehension team. So with that, Chief Data Officer Harn, all yours.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm honored to be here today. And I quickly wanted to state that I'm here in lieu of my boss, Dean Giamas, who had a mishap, and he wanted me to convey his regrets for not being able to join you today. The things I wanted to speak about very briefly was the importance of transparency to LA County Sheriff's Department and our process to date. The Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department joined the White House Police Data Initiative at a unique time, as we had faced several crises involving our custody operations and patrol services. When Sheriff McDonald took office, he emphasized, and I quote, "From my first day as sheriff, I have sought to set a clear tone, underscoring that the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department is accountable to those we protect and serve, and that we must hold ourselves to the highest standards of integrity and constitutional policing. We must continuously earn the trust of our community," unquote. The Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department believes in being forthcoming regarding our activities and policing efforts. Transparency allows honest analysis related to the quality of our work and builds trust within the communities we serve. This approach also opens up dialogue to ensure certain concerns, crime trends, and needed corrective action is being applied in a fair and impartial manner. During this time, the Office of Inspector General was established and committed to the need for data transparency. And finally, during this time, the county actually developed and implemented an approved policy for the entire county on open data, and that was something that Director Giamas was very actively involved in. So you've got a climate over the last 3 or 4 years that open data has gone from what is it to why am I not doing it and how could I get engaged. Our initiatives coincided very nicely with the White House initiative and were the result of a thoughtful and deliberately strategic approach. We have published 9 primary data sets to date that are contextually presented in visual snapshots. The published shooting data sets reflect our internal processes and are categorized into hit shootings, non-hit shootings, warning shots, animal shootings, unintentional shootings, and other shootings. We were getting beyond just the hit and non-hit of individuals, but into getting the public aware of all the ways in which a weapon can be discharged. We also do a daily posting of all reported Part 1 and Part 2 crimes that, yes, it's dated, and we've been doing that for, gosh darn, more than 10 years. But that's something that's been very interesting as we approve and move into transparency. I thought a daily dump of data was being transparent. And it really isn't being transparent. It's saying, here's my data, figure it out if you can. So we really are working hard on saying, how do we interpret and tell that story? But we're very proud that we've taken that step. There are numerous challenges to launching a successful open data initiative. This includes a county government structure, the deputies in the importance of transparency, funding and the value of open data, and then the development of a chief data office. It's critical to assign staff that have a thorough understanding of business processes, data flow, and related systems. The CDO is an expert, knowledgeable in department operations, responsible for enterprise-wide data strategy, including governance, security, dissemination, policy development, and the effective use and exploitation of that data. And finally, transparency with the community and the stakeholders that we serve. As we stated earlier, and I think there's probably not any police departments left throughout the country that don't do public crime mapping. That's kind of been our bread and butter for years of saying we're transparent, but basically we toss out a couple of high-level crime categories like maybe Part 1 crimes, and we used to call that transparent. But that's still a good way for the public to at least see. The issue is how do we engage them? Open data is useful in effectively and visually communicating what is happening and where it's happening. Additionally, interested groups such as the Los Angeles Times can easily ingest and express our data. And with the Los Angeles Times, that was one of the first soft partners we'd had. They came at us very hard several years in wanting to reduce what our footprint was on expressing crime and come in and take a holistic view of expressing crime for the entire county of LA and all 88 cities. We participated aggressively with them and they really went through our data with a fine-tooth comb. They have a team of data scientists, so it was a very unique experience for me and I think really encouraged me to see where we could go with data. In closing, the county has really had a very interesting process in where we're at today with our data and our deputy-involved shooting data. We have strict Peace Officer Bill of Rights in the state of California that is very clear on articulating the privacy concerns of deputies and mandating laws that be followed. So the issue of dealing with unions was there, but it wasn't insurmountable because they have that as a protection that we just have the rules of the game to follow. We have our internal stakeholders, our inspector general that we partner with, our civic leadership groups, such as our board of supervisors, our chief information office, and actually the ACLU, and the deputy union. The soft launch with our media was a success when we did our force data, our deputy involved shooting data. We actually haven't done a hard announcement. We launched it, we discussed it, and we're having an iterative process to refine our data. We're better for our open data initiative as it improved our internal processes. We've built new partnerships, such as our involvement with the University of Chicago in developing an early warning system. That is a direct result of networking at last year's White House PDI meeting. Our county's open data portal, we're the third most popular data set behind salaries of everybody who works for the county in real estate. We sincerely thank the White House PDI team, especially Clarence Wardell and Denise Ross for their guidance, support, and encouragement. It's an honor for our agency to participate. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Wendy. And now let me introduce you to Assistant Chief Bob Schroeder. He's an 18-year veteran of the Louisville Metropolitan Police Department, which is really just slightly longer than I've been alive. He oversees 150 staff and a broad array of critical services for Louisville Metro, including, and this list is really impressive, so I'm actually going to read it. Training, human resources, budget, technical services, telephone services, the property room, research and development, records management, strategic planning, inspections and compliance, health and safety, false alarm reduction, vehicle empowerment, fleet operations, open record, accident review board, and the court liaison officer. Sir, thank you for being here.
Thank you. So good morning. On behalf of Chief Conrad and Mayor Fisher, I'd like to thank the president and the PDI team for inviting us to be here. I would imagine that Louisville isn't too different from any other city here. The thought of putting all of our data out online when we initially started the concept was just terrifying. What was going to happen with all our data? How were people going to use it? Where were we going to go with this journey? Well, our journey on open data actually started in early 2012 when our mayor, Greg Fisher, signed an executive order committing Metro Louisville to be an open and transparent government. This commitment to the citizens we serve would be the foundation for all the trust that we've built over the last 4 years. Our initial data sets we first put out under this initiative were kind of smaller, more filtered data sets, and people were really asking for more information. Well, in April of 2015, where we were invited to the first PDI meeting, and our prior work had primed us really for that meeting. We'd started the journey, but we hadn't gone really far down the road. During the meeting, however, we committed to releasing several more open data sets, and these included open data sets on expanded open data sets on crime, on vehicle stops, on arrests, on citations, and assaults against officers. And since those data sets first came out, we've added some additional data sets, including employee characteristics, hate crimes, and officer-involved shootings. And we are currently in the process with the group Code for America for trying to pull the complaints against officer data out of our system. When choosing a potential data set, we look at a number of sources. We get information from our open records requests, from community meetings, from civic groups, from our own internal staff. We look at what the universities and stuff are requesting for us to see really what people are interested in and what we can put out there for them. Then we determine, are there any legal or investigative restrictions on this data? And examples of that can include juvenile data, crime, rape victim data, things that we really need to protect the identities of the people involved. Once we decided on a data set, we do a test run to see how the data looks, to see if there's any unanticipated consequences of that data, any unanticipated issues. Then when we're all done, we contact our IT department, their e-government team, and have them put it out on the web. Some of the data sets we picked, we chose to increase our transparency to the public, such as our employee characteristic data. We thought it was very important with our employee characteristic data for the public to know about the officers that are protecting them and about those leaders who are guiding those officers. We included data on the officer gender, the race, their hire date, and their educational level. Other data sets we selected to give some perspective to the challenges officers face. We felt it was important to include the assault on officer data to give the public some perspective of the day-to-day dangers that officers face. Having this data included can add an important context and a level of understanding for people to understand how and why we do what we do. Well, we put all this data out there for everybody to see, but we didn't think that was enough. Someone not familiar with data, from managing data, from manipulating data, might not be able to understand what all these raw data sets actually mean. So we created our own transparency page. We wanted to basically make it easier for the public to consume. The transparency page contains virtually the same amount of data, the same types of data, only we've formatted it for them to understand it. This link currently has 14 data sets for viewing. So how do we make all this happen? It's important to note we didn't do it alone. We had strong support from Louisville's Office of Performance Improvement and our Department of Information Technology. But the single most important factor is we have a sergeant who's here with us today who has actually got the skill set to manage a project like this and to actually do the coding to make it work. We encourage any agency that wants to be truly world-class to invest in their internal technology. So today, we're proud that the White House tells us we're one of the leading agencies regarding open data. Since we started all this, the sky has not fallen. There's been no great criticism of our department. Our officers have not stopped working. In fact, we learned that our fears weren't really valid. As Chief Brown stated at the first PDI meeting, it is the public's data. Open data and transparency are not the enemy. They are our duty. We're proud of what we've done, proud of where we're going, and we hope you join us on this journey. Thank you.
So thank you very much. And so let's jump off from what Assistant Chief Schroeder said at the end there. And that is for Dallas, for Los Angeles. Tell the audience how many ways the sky has fallen since you've opened this data.
Well, there were legitimately fears from our profession of criticism. We hadn't been short on critics in our profession for many years, but even more so, we would argue it's hypocritical environment now. But it just the opposite. The media who tell stories to citizens about our profession embrace this release as a positive thing. But citizens, particularly our activists, who had preconceived notions about where and who our force is being used on, really had to take a second look at their previous beliefs because data didn't support it. And so facts became the great equalizer for us, and it really has put us in a position to open more dialogue with even our most critical citizens in our cities, because we're able to show facts over a decade that support that our officers are doing the job, and when they don't, we hold them accountable.
Wendy?
We really didn't experience any significant slam on releasing our data. I think it's just a strengthening and building and creating new dialogue and new ways of engaging with folks. And because our troops knew they had the protection of the Peace Officer Bill of Rights, that kind of took that roadblock out. It helped build credibility with our OIG office. As a matter of fact, our Inspector General, we just recently gave an open data demo to our county internal executives and some of our Board of Supervisors staff, and he spoke on our behalf and supported everything we've done with our open data. So I think, if anything, it's a bridge builder. And then with the press, as I said, with the LA Times, I think our soft launch was great, and it's just continuing to give us a new basis for increased dialogue and understanding of what the expectations are from our constituents and what it is we do and what we can offer to help.
So let me just make sure I understood. Your IG said nice things about you. Is that
yes.
What you just said?
Yes.
Okay. I hope everyone's taking notes on this. So, Assistant Chief Schroeder, this has got to be crazy expensive. I mean, you're putting out all this data. You have an officer who's an expert on this stuff. How crazy is the cost?
You know, honestly, for us, the cost really wasn't terribly expensive at all. We already had the officer on staff who was working on our technology project. We work with our Department of Information Technology's e-government team who already existed. We actually theoretically have seen a cost savings because we have crime analysts who would respond to all these data requests from universities, from citizens, just asking for general data. And now they can say, hey, we've already got this data available for you on the website. Send them there, and that saves the staff time from them having to prepare that and put other projects to the side.
Wendy, how much does this cost LA?
Well, the costs are in person hours only. It was really great that, again, LA County adopted an open data policy, and they partnered with Socrata and established the platform for all the users in the county departments that would be publishing open data. So that saved us that step. We spent at least 1,400 hours developing our initial data set, and it's an ongoing relationship to extract our data, process and cleanse our data, and post our data in an effective way. And I know we're going to be, that's just a new role. It's a new thing we have to do. And I think the return of that cost is the quality of what we do.
And Chief Brown, the cost to Dallas?
Very, very minimal expenses, but the value has been off the charts. When I think about cost, I think about revenue minus expenses. That's your cost. So I would say the revenue has been a groundswell of trust, and the value has been, again, off the charts across the board. And you always have critics internally in the organization that just won't change. That's a given, but that's a fixed cost. The value of what you're building in the community by being transparent with your data will pay dividends for generations in your department.
Wendy, how big is your staff? How many people do you have working on this project?
I have me. We don't have any dedicated staff in the chief data office, but what I have to do is partner in because it's the sheriff's, one of his top three mandates to have open data. It becomes a priority within our technology division that Dean Giammas heads, and staff are allocated to assist in doing that as collaterals. We hope to gain staff, but that has not been able to happen yet.
I feel your pain.
Thank you.
Chief Brown?
Yes.
How many people do you have working on this project?
We already had dedicated people to manage our data, our RMS systems, all of our crime data that we deploy resources around, and we just added to their work. We all have to multitask. We all have to do more than one thing. But once you go back as far as you can and publish whatever that data is, the go forward is just adding that next incident to the data. So there's not go forward work. There's catch-up work, obviously, if you haven't been releasing your data. But the go-forward work is fairly seamless, not much additional labor to the people who are already managing our data.
Mm-hmm. Assistant Chief Schroeder, how many staff do you have working on this?
So currently we have one sergeant who does primarily most of the data pulls. We have a set of crime analysts who may do it part-time. But we are actually in the process of trying to hire two data analyst just to work on projects like this and then some of our own internal data requests as well.
So, Wendy, the officers have got to hate this. I mean, you're putting their data up there online. Tell the audience how many ways the officers hate this.
They don't hate it. They're fine. There wasn't any big bumps or burps. Primarily because of that Peace Officer's Bill of Rights, which dictated what kind of data we can post and cannot post. There was only two columns in data, and I forget what that was after we'd posted our shooting data that we were requested to pull because they felt it would possibly identify the deputy involved. And really, that's been minimal. Other than that, we're moving full speed ahead.
Chief Brown? Your officers, how do they feel about this?
Well, there's been a little passive-aggressive behavior, just a little. Misdirection, you know. But that comes with, it's what we signed up for. We have to win the narrative. We have to shape the context of why the data is important. We have to remind ourselves that we're servants for citizens and get on down the road. I mean, the horse is out of the barn, I think. Transparency is just a building block for trust in the community. And given that their tax dollars pay our salaries, whatever internal strife you might have is worth it. It's worth it. I don't want to paint a rosy picture that you won't have pushback from certain elements within your organization, particularly people who are old school. But again, the value is so great, it's worth the pushback.
Assistant Chief Schroeder, same question to you. How are the officers dealing with this?
Well, you know, there's been no hue and cry, and honestly, I'm not aware of any pushback, but we took some steps, like when we released the employee characteristic data, we shielded the individual names of the officers and the civilian employees, whereas in other sets of data, like the officer-involved shootings, we actually do name the officer. But our thinking in going along with that is after an officer-involved shooting, we're going to name the officer to the media anyway. That's going to be out there anyway. And I have not had any comments from any of our line staff regarding the issue.
So if the officers don't hate it, then the community must hate it, okay? So Chief Brown, how many ways do the community hate this?
Well, let me count the ways. Zero. Zero. It's just amazing. I'm a third generation Dallasite, so I know this community real well. Where this incident happened that I described, my parents live right down the street from there. Great-grandparents live not far from there. So these people knew me. And so the releasing facts of data really dispels probably generations of preconceived notions about race and police. You go back to Jim Crow era when police were enforcing those unjust Jim Crow laws in the South. And so people pass that on to kids, grandkids, great-grandkids. What dispels those myths and challenges police to correct when you have error are the facts. And so the public embraces that. They embrace honesty and transparency. And they know we're human. We're going to make mistakes. It's when you try to hide your mistakes, it's where you lose the trust of citizens. So being honest and being transparent, people have embraced this in Dallas.
Wendy, how about the community in Los Angeles? How have you seen them express their feelings about this data?
Community is very supportive. And in general, we have a consent decree in Antelope Valley that mandates the publication of stop data. So there you have relationships that take a little more repairing and building, and the transparency goes a great way in getting the public behind what we're doing again, making sure we're heard and they hear us. Our shooting data, we have gotten, at least I have gotten, perhaps the executives had, very little feedback. Where I would have gotten a lot of feedback many years ago on crime data, it seems that as we publish more data, it's almost an expectation that the data's there, they know it's there when they want to see it, we refresh it as incidents are updated, and it will be interesting when we post the force data to see if that trend continues. We're finding our stakeholders, like our Board of Supervisors, are very interested in looking at the data because they're the ones that engage locally with their constituents, and they really appreciate the power and value of our transparency in assisting them with their jobs.
So we've been on this panel for a long time. Do you mind if I just call you Rob?
go right ahead.
Okay, I just want to. Rob, how is the Louisville community feeling about this data release?
Actually, the community has really, really embraced it. We have a local civic data community that has been asking for data like this for years, and they are ecstatic that they were able to get this. And when we released the transparency page I spoke of earlier, we actually did an interview with our local paper, and to our surprise, it was actually the front page of the Sunday edition celebrating the efforts at transparency we had made.
David, all right?
Yes,
all right.
Of course.
You cited some insane numbers on police shootings, on use of force complaints. What exactly do you feel is the link between those numbers and this transparency?
I think when people believe you're being honest with them, they trust you. And that when something goes awry, they give you the benefit of the doubt. And, you know, this complaint data is citizens who would complain 100-fold have decided to give us the benefit of the doubt. They believe that we'll correct the behavior in our department, and we'll put it on display for everyone to see and have an opinion about. I've been following this discussion on Twitter. There's been over 100 tweets trending on Twitter, guys, and one person, though, said don't release data. And I was about to say something to him on Twitter back, and then he tweeted, rest in peace, Prince, and I left him alone. What can I say?
So let's continue to go a little crazy here. Wendy, is there anything tangible that you can point to that has changed as a result of this greater transparency around data?
Internally, definitely. How we document and look at the collection of information, our value of how we collect and document the information from an investigative report, how we enter that information. A lot of the data we've had and that we've stored, we've collected force and shooting incidents for 15, 20 years. But the data really didn't lend itself to publishing for open data. We had to go back in, review incidents, amend and add information, because we had to get out of a case-by-case mindset and into a broad-based data set. And if there's anything I would suggest to anyone is really take a good look at how you're documenting and entering that data, even from geocoding. We experienced issues because we weren't standardizing how we were capturing that in a force report because it wasn't handled the way a crime report or a booking of an individual was handled.
Rob, tangible things that have happened since you've released this data, what can you speak to?
So a lot like Wendy, in particular, our officer-involved shooting data was not in any format that would have lent itself to that. So we actually had to create that, which required a lot of manual work to do. It's also made us take a look at our data quality. You know, what are the officers putting in? Are they doing every step they need to take? And we found in several of our data sets where there was just a lot of missing data. And you'll find that in our employee characteristic data in particular, where we're missing educational level on a lot of our employees. So those are things that we have to go back and fix. So it's really made us up our game as far as the data quality aspect.
So, I mean, just to take your words on that, you're saying that the transparency has actually improved the data?
Transparency is making us improve our own data, yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, you know, David, you've been a police chief longer than there's been data, or at least a police officer. You've gone from old school to what we're doing now.
Right.
There are a lot of people who've been in policing for a long time. What would you tell them about why they should be more data transparent? How would you tell them to get there? What are your words of wisdom to them?
Right. I try to make it a pocketbook issue. People understand pocketbook issues. So these citizens who need to trust us give us some of their tax money to pay our salaries. So if you want raises, you want to advocate for benefits, pension fixes, be attentive to the people that are going to spend their money to get that done. And so once it becomes a pocketbook issue, it's an easier conversation on why this data is important to release, why use of force data is important to release, why we need to be as transparent as possible and hold officers who might not follow the rules accountable, so that the citizens who pay our salaries will continue to support us when we want raises and other benefits.
Mm-hmm. Wendy, give your best kind of sell. You're dealing with another chief data officer. They're teetering as to whether or not they're going to join the police data initiative. What would you tell them as to why or why they should not join this thing?
Well, if you don't want to join the police data initiative, you ought to second guess being a chief data officer. this is it for chief data officers. This is the excitement that we've all been waiting for years, to mash and smash and create and show data and see the possibilities of what we can do with data as we work with our communities and internally. And it's such an exciting time. I'm sorry it's toward the end of my career, because the next few years, it's just going to get more and more exciting about what we learn, what we do, and what we become in law enforcement. And I'm very excited to be a part of that and encourage any agency to jump on board.
Rob, final words on this?
You know, kind of along Wendy's point, you know, when we started out, we had a lot of fear, and there is nothing to fear. Police are going to have incidents that occur over time, and to get through those incidents requires a level of trust with the community. And the only way you're going to get that trust is being open and honest with your community. And putting your data out there for them to see how you work, see how you operate, is one of the first steps you can take to build a higher level of trust with your community.
So let me just summarize a little bit of what I've heard here. Your IG likes you. There are cost savings. The value is off the charts. Low staffing. Officers don't hate it. Dispels preconceived notions. The community has really embraced it. When something goes awry, you're given the benefit of the doubt. And transparency makes the data better. Have I properly summarized what we've gone through in this panel? So you'd kind of be dumb not to do this. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes,
definitely.
All right. So so folks know, I've actually loved data for a long time, but I loved crime data. That's the data that I was always pushing. We need more crime data. We need better crime data. This is the change now, is this policing data. And so when Clarence and Denise came to me, they were talking about policing data. And I'm like, I don't get it. Why do you want to put policing data up there? They said, well, no, we don't want to put it up there. We're going to get departments to volunteer to do it. And that's when I almost kicked Clarence and Denise out of my office, because no one's going to voluntarily put this stuff up there. We are now a year later, and this is incredible. I don't know, there are many things that the law enforcement profession has gone from 0 to 50 in 1 year in, you know, 53 jurisdictions that are now doing this, that is so incredibly impactful at a time when community and police relations are at the front burner of so many of our conversations. And so I want to just, again, as others have said, I want to thank you so much for the, because the people in this room are already those who have accepted this challenge and have decided that they're going forward with this. So I want to thank all of you for doing that and for moving forward and for being part of the leaders. So we have 53 down. That leaves us with about 1,750 to go. All right. Or 17,950 to go. But I think we're going to make it there. And let me just say that, you know, I would die for all of you. Thank you very much.
Well played.
Good job, man.
How's everyone doing? Heard a lot of laughter on the other side of the door there. That's good. So next we have a really special treat, and it is my distinct honor and pleasure to introduce Ms. Valerie Jarrett, who is the senior advisor to President Barack Obama, overseeing the White House offices of public engagement and intergovernmental affairs, and chairing also the White House Council on Women and Girls. Ms. Jarrett has worked throughout her tenure at the White House to mobilize elected officials, business and community leaders, and diverse groups of advocates behind efforts to strengthen and improve access to the middle class, to boost American businesses and our economy, and to champion equality and opportunity for all Americans. From ongoing campaigns to end sexual assault, raise the minimum wage, advocate workplace policies that empower working families, promote entrepreneurship and early childhood education, and lead the efforts of the administration on reforming our criminal justice system. Ms. Jarrett has helped the President develop a broad coalition of partners to execute a robust agenda. Ms. Jarrett came to the White House with a background in both the public and private sectors, having served as the Chief Executive Officer of the Habitat Company in Chicago, Chairman of the Chicago Transit Board, Commissioner of Planning and Development, and Deputy Chief of Staff to Chicago Mayor Richard M. Daley. She also served as the co-chair of the Obama-Biden Presidential Transition Team, and is the director of the corporate and not-for-profit boards, including chairman of the board of the Chicago Stock Exchange, chairman of the University of Chicago Medical Center Board of Trustees, and director of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. I would also like to say, as a fellow alum of the University of Michigan, Ms. Jarrett also holds a law degree from the University of Michigan and a bachelor's from Stanford University. It is a great honor and privilege to welcome her to the stage. Thank you.
Thank you, Clarence, for that introduction. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
We are so delighted to have you here. When the Task Force on 21st Century Policing was completed their work, and one of the recommendations was to focus on data, we had no idea that in such a short period of time we would have 53 different law enforcement agencies from around the country commit to this. And 39 of you are here today. And so for those of you in law enforcement, I want to begin by thanking you for your service, your commitment to your communities, the sacrifices that you and your loved ones make every day as you put yourself in harm's way to protect our citizens. So can we have a round of applause for those who protect us? And we are thrilled that you are here today. And I know that we're going to spend the day talking about our data initiative. And I want to begin with a story of how it really came home to me. I was out in Compton last year. And I know there is someone here from LA and LA County. And I visited a courtroom, juvenile court, presided over by Judge Pratt. And what the judge had noticed over a period of time and began to collect the data was the number of young girls who were coming through her courtroom for a whole variety of different offenses. And what they had in common was that they were all victims of commercial sexual exploitation. And so once she collected that data, she was able, working with local law enforcement, the prosecutors, social service organizations, counselors, probation officers, you name it, to tailor a program to help these young girls break their cycle of crime and become contributing members of society. And I had lunch with a group of these young women, and I asked them what they wanted to do when they grew up. And they all wanted to do service. Some wanted to teach, some wanted to help trauma victims, some wanted to give back in their community and do public service. And it really brought home to me how many young people in our country just need to get that second chance, and that if we all are working together with them, our streets will be safer. And so when we think about criminal justice reform more broadly and all of the efforts that the president, partnering with many of you, are trying to put in place, the first priority, his first priority every single day, is to keep America safe. And we will do that more effectively if we do it smarter. And collecting data is an important way for us to be smarter as we try to fight crime and try to help our citizens lead law-abiding, productive lives. So more broadly, our criminal justice initiative is designed in three buckets. And the president outlined this in the speech that he gave to the NAACP last summer. The first bucket is community. And so obviously, community policing is a very important part of that strategy. What can we do to ensure that our young people break that school-to-prison pipeline, break that sexual assault-to-prison pipeline, have alternatives? Broderick Johnson runs the President's My Brother's Keeper initiative, so particularly for boys and young men of color, what can we do to make sure they get that fair shot and that they don't get caught up in the criminal justice system? So it's everything from early childhood education to ensuring that those who start in the juvenile system don't go right into the feeding ground for the adult system. We're working with school districts around the country to try to reduce the number of suspensions and expulsions from school, because of course, if young people are out of school, the likelihood of them getting into trouble goes up dramatically. But at the same time, young people who are destructive in the classroom, we can't expect the teachers to solve that problem alone. So what can we do to give the teachers the support that they need, again, to help people when they are young? The second pillar is the courtroom. And there is legislation now moving through both the House and the Senate. It's bipartisan. And let me tell you, there are not that many things in this town where we have bipartisan cooperation. But this is one that we're feeling very good about. And so the Judiciary Committees of both the House and the Senate have passed bills, and we're hoping to move forward expeditiously. And the goal there is to, number one, reduce the mandatory minimums for nonviolent drug offenses, and to help those folks get into drug treatment programs, to get into diversion programs, again, with the goal of making them productive members of society. So many people, as you all know, who get caught up in the system and end up incarcerated, end up coming out, and we have 600,000 people a year who come out of our prisons, and they come out worse than when they went in. So what can we do at the front end in the courtroom to make sure that the punishment actually tailors the crime? Then we want to have to look at what happens while they're incarcerated. What kind of programs do we have, either for job training or education programs or drug treatment programs, social service, psychological services? So during the time of incarceration, we're helping people so when they leave, they are better off. One of the reports that came out recently from the Justice Department at the President's request was, how are we treating solitary confinement? What are the psychological impacts that solitary confinement are having, particularly on young people? And the evidence shows traumatic, deleterious impact. And so let's tailor solitary confinement to eliminate it for young people and make sure that we're using it sparingly for the adult population. The Justice Department, and you'll hear, I'm sure, from them, are working at creating programs in the federal system while people are incarcerated, help them get back on their feet. And cities and states around the country, we know, are doing the same. The statistics on criminal justice are pretty staggering. I always start with the story first because we want to keep our focus on the human consequences of what it is at times an inhumane system. But we spend $80 billion a year on incarceration, even at the federal level. That's a big number. We have 5% of the world's population, yet we have 25% of the world's incarcerated. 2.2 million people are incarcerated right now. 1 in 3 adults who are working age have had some sort of interaction with the criminal justice system. And for women, the number of women who are incarcerated has gone up 400% since in the last 30 years. those statistics are unsustainable. And for those of you representing counties and who have county jails, we have 11 million people in our jail system around the country in any given year. They stay an average of 23 days, and only 5% are ultimately convicted and sentenced to prison. So just imagine the cost of holding those folks for 23 days, many who simply can't afford bail. And so what happens in that 23-day period? Well, you lose your job. If you're a single mom, you may lose custody of your children. And you come out, and you still have often the fines and penalties that may have sent you in the first place, and yet no ability to pay them back. And so then what happens? Nothing good. So we are really taking a comprehensive look at how we're approaching criminal justice reform, again, with the first priority being keeping America as safe as possible. And the more information we have, the better our data is, the more informed our public policies will be. And so, again, that's why we are so delighted to have you all here. We are hoping, as we are streaming this around the country, that there are cities and counties around the country who are going, well, wait a minute, why aren't we there? And that this initiative will only grow tenfold in short order. So I'll close the way I started, which is to thank those of you in law enforcement for your service to our country. Thank you for your willingness to come here and share your best practices with us today. And I hope you have a terrific day. Thank you, everybody.